Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Capulets and Montagues, welcome to another episode of the Completely Mental Misadventures of a Thrift Store. I am Matt Lehman, the owner of Finders Thrift and Vinyl in the Kings of California, where all of our stories are warehoused and recorded. Today, I am joined by one of my best friends. We've been as thick as thieves for quite a while. His name is Michael Gaylor, attorney at law.
Dun, 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 dun.
I feel like it should have that music.
Oh, yeah.
Like a big 80s montage. He's joining us because we're going to talk about laws of reselling and mostly to do with storage or auctions. And I have an interesting story that happened that came to third party. I haven't been to auctions this week or part of last week because my parents were in town and a lot of them were online. I was looking online, but I happened to miss the clutter. And as you know, you listen to the auction, and you're listening to the podcast, and anybody that's listened to the podcast before knows that I love clutter. Clutter's down in Ontario, and they do pallet auctions, and it's just like gambling. They're like giant slot machines, and you get to pick one pallet and take it home, or five pallets, whatever you want. And I missed that because I wasn't paying attention to the auctions, and I don't know how I missed it, but one of the other auctionees called me and asked if I was going. I was like, what auction? And he said, Ontario. I was like, oh, no, I'm not driving that far. And then he started saying pallets. I was like, are you telling me clutter was today? And he's like, yes. I was like, oh, I can't believe I missed it. But so on those pallets, like clutter is real hit or miss. The last one I went to was just garbage. The two before that were gangbusters. We made a ton of money on them, or I made a ton of money on them. This one, he called me because I have some, experience in the world that he was dealing with. Is every pallet had vintage guitar gear, amps, guitars, and with clutter, sometimes you can open the pallets and see what's in there. So they were letting you open guitar cases. So he's sending me pictures of guitars. He's sending me pictures of amplifiers. He had a Fender Bassmaster that was number 5 of 10, made specifically for one music shop in L.A., and it was a tube amp. I mean, it was a reproduction tube amp, but it was just unbelievably expensive. But the reason that you're here is to discuss this is once the auctioneer, so this is American Auctioneers, and if you know American Auctioneers, they are storage wars. That's their TV show, that's Dan Dobson. Dan was not there, Dan and Laura were not there. Their auctioneer, one of their auctioneers is there, and I like that auctioneer. I'm not going to throw him under the bus here, but I like that auctioneer. He's very nice, and he's always been cordial to me. But once he got there and saw that there were 22 pallets, all of them had vintage guitars, vintage gears. One of them had was nothing but a pallet of tubes. And if you deal in that market, you know that there are some tubes out there, especially for gear. Music gear are worth a fortune. Nothing but a pallet. Once, what is it, a 4x4 pallet, and it was 4 feet high of tubes. Nothing but tubes. Once he saw all this stuff, and so I assume the auction started at 9, he probably gets there at 8:30 because he's got to inventory it and docket it. The auction's supposed to start at 9, and all of a sudden at 9 o'clock he's like, oh no, we're running behind, we've got to do some more inventory and blah, blah, blah. They postponed the auction for an hour and a half, so the auction actually started at 10:30. Reason they started at 10:30 is because they were waiting for the big buyers to come in. So he called the other big buyers, the ones from TV. One of them is from TV. Actually, he's the brother of one of the people on TV. And then the other one is a very big auction house in Southern California. And they're both very, very big buyers. So I'm glad I didn't go to that because after they showed up, every pallet went for $5,000 or more. Which you can't blame American auctioneers for doing it. However, the fact that they did that and held the auction for an hour and a half is really, really pretty douchey and really piss-poor business, in my opinion, because you have pretty much just given a big F-you to your everyday buyers, the buyers that come to every one of your auctions, the ones that will buy your $5 unit so you don't have to clean them out, the ones that just keep the ball rolling and not the ones that spend $5,000 on a storage unit. You just really just gave them a big F you.
Yeah, I can see why you would think that. But you have to remember what area of the law governs storage auctions.
No, I don't have to think about it. That's what you're here for. That's your job.
So let me explain it to you. What you have to remember is that it's governed by a code section that was created probably not until the 60s called the Uniform Commercial Code. And the whole idea of it was is old school contract law, which governed the sale of everything back in the day, was not commerce friendly. It required contracts to be complete mirror images of each other. It required that both parties had the same mindset when they were making the purchase or when they were making the sale. The problem is even if you look at modern commerce, can you imagine trying to do everything by contract on eBay or on Amazon or whatever you're doing? So the UCC was created to streamline commerce and to streamline sale of product and to make it easier for people to exchange goods for cash on a regular daily basis. It only covers the sale of goods or items, which are things that can be touched, felt, moved, and you can identify it when you're doing it. So the UCC has a code section that covers auctions, and the idea behind that code section is it gives the auctioneers a lot of power, unless they've relinquished that power prior to the auction starting, to control things such as when we're going to start, how we're going to start, even whether or not they can reopen an auction, whether they can withdraw the item if the auction doesn't go high enough or well enough or good enough for the seller.
And usually again, that's a reserve, but they don't have to. But what you're saying, obviously, there are certain places that have reserves for auctions, but auctioneers don't necessarily have to follow that anyway. But it's bad business for them to do that. They try not to do it anyway.
Well, the reality is unless they say specifically no reserve, it is a reserved auction. They don't have to tell you it's reserved or not. They just have to say if it's not, then it's a no reserve auction.
Correct.
And the idea behind it, again, is to if you open up bidding on something and somebody says a dollar because nobody else is interested in it, then the auctioneer can withdraw it, especially if he knows, hey, maybe on a different day, a different time, a different place, this will sell for more. The interesting part of that is how it's relating to online auctions, to me at least, because I know you've done most of that, you and I have talked a lot about that, is that with online auctions, I'm curious to see what the standard is going to be for a reasonable time, because the code only says a reasonable time to reopen it if there was a missed bid.
Right. See, and we had talked about it because I called you on one auction,
yes,
and it was one of the largest purchases I had made online. I think I put
a lot down on that.
$3,000. I was bidding three mm-hmm. grand plus fees. So by the time I had fees and everything done, I was pushing $4,000 on this unit.
Yep.
And it was one of, and I was sitting here sweating bullets because I'm like, geez, I just dropped $4,000 on a unit. I don't even know what's in it.
Can't smell it.
And I got a call from them a day later, or maybe it was. I think it was the same day, but I think it was several hours later, and I got an email from them first that said they canceled the auction. Now, this is after the auction had ended, hammer dropped. My understanding of the legal auction world is once the hammer falls, it's no longer, it's now I'm the rightful owner. Now, that what they were telling me was until money changes hands, they can end an auction prior to. I thought that they were trying to end it because they felt it should have gotten more.
Well, that's the gray area, because technically the auctioneer can reopen it and end it, but it has to be done for a reasonable within a reasonable time frame for a reasonable purpose. So you're looking at things like a missed bid.
Right.
You're looking like things like, okay, that wasn't the dollar amount that they were supposed to sell it for. But the online industry is changing that, because if you're at an auction facility and there's a missed bid, or you're at an auction facility and there is not a reserve that's been met, if there was a reserve or even if they didn't disclose it, but they should have. The problem you've got now is the online industry has taken your marketplace from being the 20, 30, 40, 50 people that are sitting there to now having 2,000, 3,000. I mean, look at eBay.
Sure.
eBay is a perfect example of it.
I firmly agree with that. And people ask me what I think of online and live auctions. I prefer live auctions because you can smell them, you get a better feel for the units. But I think once they iron out all of the flaws with online auctions, I think it's just brilliant. But the problem with that is you're asking someone that's managing a storage rental property for $15 an hour to go take good pictures of a storage unit. Why do they care? They're not getting any benefit out of it. So you see bad pictures, And I agree. I get to travel farther, and I can sit in the shop, which means I don't have to pay an employee or somebody to watch the shop to go to a live auction. I can sit here at the shop and bid on units in San Diego or Los Angeles or Phoenix and sometimes Vegas, whereas I would never have done that. I would never drive to Vegas for an auction.
But with those kind of advances are going to come new challenges. And the new challenges within the law are, okay, look back to privacy laws 25 years ago that didn't even include things like Facebook, Facebook images, MySpace images, all those things. People were pulling those pictures off, and the argument was, well, you made it public. So once you made it public, it's no longer a private image. It took a while for the laws to catch up, and a lot of that's because what it's going to take at some point in time is some little auction online site is going to do something. They're going to get sued for it. Once they get sued for it, they're going to want to fight it, and they're going to pay the money to have it be an appealed case. Once it's appealed, then it's going to go to the state level, and then possibly even from the state level, go to the Supreme Court level. Until that happens, you're not going to see substantial change or substantial case law, because case law has to come from the appellate level or above. The problem is if you filed a case right now, you probably wouldn't settle it for 2 or 3 years or get a judgment for 2 or 3 years. And once you got the judgment, it's going to take you at least a year to get it into appeals. And once you get it into appeals, it's going to take you another year to finally get it out, or either a confirmation or overturn on it. So if you started the process now, you're looking at 4 to 5 years before you realistically would have substantiated case law that would change or start setting down a series of rules that people could go by.
And the only case that would even consider being brought with that in mind would be someone whose merchant, or not merchandise, I always say merchandise, whose personal possessions were sold, I guess it would be illegally or out of term, you know. I mean, yep. it wasn't quite ready for auction. And they could very easily. There could be problems. Like if every auction has to be listed in a newspaper somewhere. So if they missed one or typed in someone's name wrong, then that's where you go. Because we had talked about the one that we just talked about, 4,000. I asked, "What are my ramifications on that?" And you're like, "Nothing." He's like, "You were probably in the right at the time, but you couldn't." What are you going to do? You can't prove any loss. There's no loss for you. You couldn't even prove what the value of the unit was. So even if there was a loss, you don't even know what the value was because you didn't see it.
The only thing you could have sued for was specific performance. And that would require, it's a theory in law that's by equity. So what's the value of it? We have no idea. You haven't been able to go through it. You haven't been able to look at it. So specific performance grants you the right to say, no, storage facility, you need to give me exactly the contents that are in there. The problem with that is...
Well, see, that's interesting because, so, a lot of times storage facilities will list an auction, a unit that's gone up for sale, but the tenant will pay up, and then they will pay up and make amends, and they're fine, and they go through the storage unit and pull out the stuff they want, and then they get behind on their bills again, and it goes back to auction, but the auctioneer, and this has happened to a couple people where... They use the old original pictures of the unit, and when the buyer got there, it was a completely different unit because boxes had been moved, and they said, hey, what's going on here? And that has happened with one of the big online companies. And
that's actionable.
The friend that was Daffy Duck had that happen to him.
That's an actionable thing because that technically is fraud and misrepresentation. Yeah. So that's you can sue.
Well, he got his money back. They paid him out, gave him all of his money back, and there was no harm, no foul. And that was through the website.
I would argue that. Well, yeah, it would be no harm, no foul because they had been made amends, so they had the right to go back in. Now, if they hadn't made amends, so for example, I know.
Well, you know Daffy Duck, and you know that he threw a fit.
Oh, I'm sure he did. But I look at a unit that I'm not going to say the guy, but I know a guy that had two storage units, and they were at a storage facility. He got behind on his bills, and he paid one unit up in current, went to the unit to clear that one out, and realized that the unit right next to it that was also his, they hadn't put the second padlock on. So he opened it up, cleared all the stuff out of that one as well, closed it back up, and left the lock on there even. He just walked away like it didn't even happen. So in a case like that, if you had taken a picture of it before he emptied it and sold it when you should have padlocked it, that would be negligence on the part of the storage facility,
right.
And therefore it's a misrepresentation, and you could sue for what the expected anticipated value was inside that unit, but you didn't get the benefit of it.
When did that happen to you?
It was about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. I think you called me when you were at the storage auction. There was a Del Taco bag in the box.
Oh, I do remember that.
That was before I was done with law school and an upstanding legal professional.
That was a unit you bought at auction, wasn't it?
Hmm. That was my personal stuff.
That's awesome.
I haven't bought a unit for years. The last one I bought was the one I got toasted on with the car. No, the car one I made money on.
Oh God. So Mike was toying with storage units, and he's the one that we bought the pastor's unit where they were doing
porno pastor.
Porno pastor where they were doing bikini car washes for the church, and we found all sorts of money in envelopes.
Offerings. Yep.
Offering envelopes.
That you wanted to keep.
That is not true. We said going into it, I said we, and I agree.
We found money.
Yeah, we will donate X percent. I think we did 20% or whatever it was, 10 or 15%.
Actually, no. I think we gave anything that was in an offering envelope, I think we donated. If I'm not, loose money, we did 20% on the loose money because we did find some loose cash in the piano bench. But if I'm not mistaken, anything we found in the envelopes, we donated. But we said that as long as we made our money back on the unit, which we did, then we would donate it. If we didn't, we were going to keep it and then do 20% of that amount.
So we kept the money that smelled like hot wax and coconut oil.
The really dirty.
Yeah, we kept that.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
because we wouldn't feel right if donating that to the church.
That would just be nasty.
That's bad.
You don't want your pastor touching that.
So we had that, but he also, against my better judgment, bought a storage unit that had a car that had been stripped down in it.
For $5.
But I told him, I was like, dude, that is so hard to get rid of. Because if you buy a car at an auction, even if it's parts, you can't just take a car or parts or frame or half an engine to a junkyard because they have laws that they have to follow. And if you do not have a clear title or a pink slip, they will not take it. And you can't get a pink slip or title for a salvaged junk pile of metal. I remember them dragging that out of
But here's how you not get around it, but this is the way the law worked. The only reason I was interested in it is because I heard the auctioneer say that they did have a lien title. So when you bought the unit, I took the lien title. I had to make the DMV appointment. That kind of sucked. Made the DMV appointment, went down there with the lien title, paid my $15, got my paperwork signed. And my family is involved heavily in hydraulic businesses and hydraulic industry, so I have plenty of tow truck drivers that owe me favors. So I paid my tow truck guy when he got off duty $5 to help me drag it out, put it on the flatbed, and take it to the recycle center. And I got $495 in recycle weight for it. So
that's fair.
The only one I ever lost money on was the guy with all the one you told me not to buy that was like an abandoned unit where it was all the bags of clothes and I found all the Spotlight 29 and Trump 29 casino stuff in. That one killed me.
I remember. I think of you every time I go to that storage facility because the marks on the pavement from where they dragged that car out are still there, and I see them like, oh, that's where they dragged the car out.
That location was always good to me though, because that's the one where
that's
I got the video one. Yeah, I got all the all the ceiling fans. I sold those at $50 a pop on Craigslist, and I made my money back on that quick because I only paid like $75, and there was like 12 ceiling fans with blades in there, so I made it good on that one. The car one, I made money on it. Lost money on the abandoned unit, which was garbage.
Yeah,
I think we did like 4 garage sales on that, trying to get rid of that stuff.
Oh, I do remember the garage sales. I don't remember them. They're foggy because
they were
Bloody Mary mimosa.
We were doing Bloody Marys at 7 o'clock in the morning, trying to play chess. But that one was good, or that one was bad. I made really good money on the Snow Village one. That was the one
where I forgot about that one.
That was over there off of in Palm Desert across from the Del Taco over there on Varner Road.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That one got shady for a while. That was one of the places where they were pretty sure, and allegedly.
Staging.
Because I don't want to get in trouble. Allegedly, their managers were going through the units, pulling out the stuff, and staging them.
But see, that's why I liked that unit, because there was nothing in it but about 12 boxes off to the side and that old Edison record player cabinet.
Yeah.
That was all that was in there. So I know he hadn't touched it. So, and I got it for, but I saw the one little thing that said Department 56 down on the bottom corner of the big outer box. So I was like, okay, if those are all Department 56, it was coming up on Christmas. Okay, I'll take a shot on it. And I think I got the unit for $50. I sold the Edison cabinet for $125 here when I was shop sitting for you one time.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You brought it in here. That was when we went to look at Chelsea.
Yep. And then I sold the Snow Village. I kept the Snow Village pieces I wanted. I gave the rest to Mom that I didn't want, that she was interested in. And then I think I sold the other, I think I sold like 12 pieces on eBay. It was like the last thing I did on eBay forever ago. I made like $30-$40 a piece on them, so I didn't do too bad.
That's good.
Now I know Snow Village doesn't sell for garbage anymore.
I was going to say, I see it because I always remember that from you, and because you at that point knew that stuff, and I'm like, I've never heard of this stuff before in my life.
Yep.
But I've seen it since, and it doesn't sell very well.
Not anymore. Well, it got mass-produced. The first probably three or four runs that they did were all smaller production levels. And then they got commercial about year five, where they started bringing like Harley Davidson and McDonald's and Hershey's and all that stuff and doing them. And then after that, everything was so mass-produced that it's just like toys and comic books and baseball cards.
Well, I don't have any issues with them. They don't do it anymore, but I didn't have any issues with them going through the units. I mean, obviously, I would prefer that they did not. But I also realize, again, they were paying 18, 19, 20-year-olds $15 an hour to go through the storage units. So what they're pulling out is not where the money is. I mean, they may be, if they happen to find jewelry and they were smart enough, maybe they pulled it, but probably not. Mm-hmm. But they were pulling crap that they thought was valuable, and they really missed a lot of the good stuff. So as long as you weren't overbidding on something, you could still do fairly well. But you had to be very, very careful with them.
Well, it's like the Edison record player cabinet. If it hadn't been for my dad loving those things as a kid, I mean, the minute I folded up the lid, I knew I was right because there was the original gold leaf Edison symbol on the inside of it. So
it's tough to find those in pristine condition. Mm-hmm. And yours
pretty solid.
Was pretty solid, I would say pristine, especially now that I'm in the record business. Having seen several of them, the cabinet that you had was very, very pristine. Yep. So what are the legal ramifications of that? Like, what's, if somebody were caught, or if you could prove that a facility was staging a unit or digging through a unit prior to, I mean, obviously those are two different issues, because if they're going through a unit before it goes to auction, they're actually
breaking
the law towards the tenant, because then it's not a legal sale, but then they're also fraud or whatever you want to call it.
Well, so you've got two sides of it. The first one would be a criminal side, theoretically. It'd be a misdemeanor crime, but if they're going through violating the code that says they're not allowed to go through the unit and pull stuff out and tweak it or go through it, that it's a misdemeanor criminal act. Are they going to get in too much trouble? Probably not. I mean, maybe a little bit, but it's not going to be crazy.
Yeah.
The bigger money on that situation, though, is on the backside. If they're doing that and staging it to show a few good things up front and you can prove it, you could theoretically sue under the theory of misrepresentation. It's a tort case. It's a civil case. You've got to be able to prove your damages when you go through it, but
What would your damages even be? Like, okay, let's say I paid $1,000 for the storage unit, or my damages, you can't prove anything more than the $1,000.
And that's it. So what you realistically be doing is seeking to be made whole again. So
what's the point?
Exactly. And that's where these people, it's like I'm helping a guy right now that's got a small claims case against him. I can't represent him in court, but I can give him legal advice. And he's getting a shakedown. It's a shakedown lawsuit. You can tell that's why the guy's damages were like $18,000, but he's doing him in small claims for $10,000 so that he doesn't stays under the limit. And that way he feels like he can get an equitable remedy or basically extort my client to coughing up money that he shouldn't really have to cough up. Long, convoluted story. But a lot of people go out, they file lawsuits, and they know they're never going to go anyplace, and they do it strictly to shake down money. But the backside is also true. You get people who do stuff that they know that no lawyer in a million years is ever going to take this case on.
Yeah.
And nobody who is in their right mind is going to spend the amount of time it takes to go fight that case over a 2 or 3 year period for a $500 unit.
Yeah.
They'll say, we'll give you back part of your money, go away. And most people go, okay, well, if I can get part of my money back, I'll figure out how to make my profit. The goal is, if you keep that threshold low enough, then nobody's going to make a stink and you can keep doing what you're doing. And it's unfortunate, but it's the reality. It takes somebody digging their heels in to say, no, I'm not going to do this anymore, before you're going to see them not do it anymore.
Right. Well, the only thing, the only case I can think of, and I don't know all of the history of this, we've talked about it, it's been in the news, or was in the news, was
the safe?
The safe. We've talked about it, but just to catch everybody up, there was, it happened here in the desert, there was a storage unit, I'm trying to figure out, this is third-party story from me. I know the people involved, but again, this is still third-party, came to me. Storage unit was sold for $60, my understanding. It had a large safe in the middle of it and a bunch of tools, landscaping tools. And the person that bought it didn't necessarily want to deal with the safe or have the necessity or have the ability to move the safe. So he sold the safe to another guy, another auctionee, for $500 with the intent, if there's anything in it, you'll give me some cash on it. Fine, no big deal. He gets the safe home. Hires a safe cracker, they crack it open, and it has $7.2 million in it. But the next day, he gets a call from the lawyer and says, "Hey, I represent so and so, and they want their product back, or they want their merchandise back, or whatever they called it." And my understanding, my part of the story where it varies from what I've heard, varies from the news stories, is he did not miss the first offer, because my understanding is it was the Mexican drug cartel.
Yeah.
And so they offered him 1.2 and said, look, we understand that you bought it fair and square. We understand that, blah, blah, blah. Here's your 1.2. No harm, no foul. No harm will come to you or your family. And you really got to think about it. And I know him, and I know he is a family man. And the fact that they got his cell phone and he wasn't involved in it, or his home phone or whatever number, or the fact that they were able to get a hold of him at all, tells you right there, you can run, but how far are you going to run?
Sometimes it's better to let sleeping dogs lie.
I would have been like, yes, sir, right away, sir, whatever you want, sir.
No, you would have asked for the safe.
I would have asked, I said, can I keep the safe?
Yes.
And that would have been it. Can I keep the safe in $100 bill or something just as a story? And then it said, oh, you want to tell a story? And I'd have been buried in the shallow grave.
Well, you have a tendency to do things that put you in awkward legal situations.
Let's not talk about that. We have lawyer-client privilege here, and I would appreciate it if you didn't talk about the time that I did that.
Sometimes you have a tendency to look for a great story without thinking about that story might get you dead.
How much of that story can we tell on here? None?
As your attorney, I would highly recommend we say very, very little. Let's just say that sometimes somebody posts stuff on Facebook and Instagram. It's not the smartest thing to post on Facebook and Instagram.
I am not going to lie. That was a very, very scary moment. I wasn't super scared because I was kind of like, well, realistically, I'm nobody. They don't really care.
I think when you got the phone call from them, that's when you got a little pucker.
This ties into the safe call. When they actually called me and said, hey, just saw this post. And I was like, I got to call my lawyer.
And luckily, I'd already kind of got wind of it a little bit from you, so I'd already started the pre-calls. And the pre-calls led to a peaceful resolution.
Peaceful resolution, yes.
Yes. I owe them a favor now, which is kind of crappy, but we'll deal with it.
Well, they may never call that favor in, but at the same time, that favor could end up making you quite a bit of money.
Or buried in a ditch somewhere. If the result's not the one they're looking for.
Yeah. The point I was bringing up with the story is, I had also heard another version of that story, which was the storage facility. Okay, so the first part of it is, that storage facility does their own auctions. They don't go through an auction company, which is a really horrible, stupid idea, because if I'm not mistaken, the point of having an auctioneer is he gives you a buffer from lawsuits, because if something happens, the auction facility...
And they're carrying the appropriate assurance for it, too.
And they're carrying the insurance for it. Now, my understanding, or the story that was told to me from another person or whatever came down the pike to me, was that unit was not supposed to have been sold. Now, I'm not sure if it wasn't supposed to be sold because whomever was paying the bills wasn't able to pay the bills, or if one of the stories I heard was that the auction house, or the, not the auction house, the storage facility was supposed to auction off the unit next to it and cut the lock on the safe unit and auction that one off instead.
Well, there's a theory in contract law and in tort law, for that matter, called a bona fide purchaser. And what that means is that if you as a purchaser initiate an offer to buy or respond to an auction, and you make a purchase in good faith that you are able to make that purchase, then the selling party who shouldn't have sold it becomes liable for the damages, and the purchasing party is allowed to keep the item because they did it in good faith, not right. knowing it was a mistake or an error, and therefore there should be no fault to that party. The problem in the case that we were talking about before, though, is that, okay, do you want to tell them that, say, hey, cartel?
I was going to say, it's really pleasant to hear you to put it word it that way,
yeah.
But then when you put Mexican drug cartel in that equation, all of a sudden all of those pretty words yeah. go out the window and you're like,
because oh, they don't care. Bath. They don't care at
no,
all.
No, they're
yeah.
not interested in your laws.
So there's a famous case, and I can't remember what it was, a car. I think it was an old Duesenberg, whatever the case was, that was not supposed to be sold at Harrogate's. It got sold. The guy bought it and was halfway home when they got told, yeah, that wasn't supposed to be sold. Our bad. You need to bring the car back. And he said, I got a purchase agreement.
It says that's
you go deal with the problem. It's not my problem anymore. And the courts found that, no, he was a bona fide purchaser. It's the auction house's mistake, and the auction house is the one that now needs to cut the check to make the other guy whole. It sounds crappy, but the end result is most of the time the courts are looking at, again, the flow of commerce. If you make every buyer paranoid, is this a valid contract? Am I entering into a valid sale? And if they're so paranoid that it's not valid that they don't enter into it, you stifle the flow of commerce. And if you stifle the flow of commerce, you stifle the economy. The UCC was designed to not let that happen, to keep commerce moving forward. Somebody's going to have to pay the price, but it shouldn't be a purchaser who bought in good faith. It needs to be the guy who screwed up and sold it, and even if it was a simple mistake, it's still his mistake, and that's who's responsible for it. They don't want to make a purchaser afraid to make a purchase.
Interesting. Moving forward, what am I allowed to sell in my shop to... Am I allowed to sell pocket knives to anyone under the age of 18? Is there... If my thoughts are, if a kid comes in and buys a pocket knife or a folding knife for me and then goes home and mom is really ticked off because he's like 15 or 16...
It's quite... You...
I'm not breaking the law. There's not a law.
No,
because... I just have to... It's bad business for me. I don't do that, is the answer.
I would probably have a disclaimer up in your shop someplace. I think we've talked about lawsuit-proofing your shop, and we haven't done that yet, but we should.
I'll get in the next episode.
A ton of disclaimers all over the place. Don't touch the shrunken head. You might catch a disease or whatever we got to put out there. Don't rub the Buddha. He's got a cowboy hat. He's violent.
He's aggressive.
Yeah, he's scary. But you should have disclaimers out that says, hey, look, number one, I reserve the right to refuse service. Because not having that in place... If you told a 17-year-old kid, no, kid, you're too young to buy this knife, I'm not going to sell it to you, and you don't have the we reserve the right to refuse service sign up, you have now violated his constitutional right to make a purchase, and you did it based off of age, which is a discriminatory act, which could put you into a litigious circumstance or situation.
Oh, looks like I'll be printing up one of those signs
yes.
tonight.
So there's various different things that I think anybody who's reselling has to look at. You and I were talking before the interview started about eBay and selling on eBay or selling on Poshmark and all these different things, is that those entities are not acting as a part of the stream of commerce. They're acting as a, like the auctioneer, they're acting as a mediator to put somebody in touch with somebody. So
it's different between the point that we were talking about was, as I saw recently that there was a lawsuit coming around. Third-party lawsuit. Somebody had sold something new in the box through Amazon. Purchaser bought, got it, and it broke or something and caused injury, failed, and they were now suing Amazon because Amazon sold it. I'm not sure of all the specifics. I don't remember all of them.
So. And the reality is that Amazon shouldn't be on the hook. They're a third-party mediary. They are not part of the true – in order to establish whether or not somebody falls in line with a product's liability case, you look at flow of commerce, flow of product. They would not typically be considered part of a flow of commerce because they didn't buy it and then resell it. They merely helped facilitate the sale. But as a lawyer, I can tell you if I was the one who got that case and you told me that you suffered severe brain injuries because you bought a football helmet off of Amazon and went out to try to play football and exploded and put shards of styrofoam in your brain, I'm totally putting Amazon on that lawsuit. The biggest reason for it is they've got the deep pockets. They got deep pockets. So they'll pay to keep it from going anyplace. Here, take $100,000, go away, and then deal with this person over here to let us off the hook. So it's kind of a – you always look for the deep pockets if you do that kind of law. I mean, I don't typically do that kind of law, but if I was in that situation, I always look to where the deepest pockets are.
Do you feel that that cheapens the legal system?
No, because I think at the end of the day, you've got – so use the example. Let's say it was a rugby helmet, okay, and this guy – or not, they don't wear helmets. They're crazy. Let's say it was a lacrosse helmet, okay, and you got this 18-year-old kid who plays lacrosse. He's in his last year, senior in high school, and he's looking at scholarships to go to some big Ivy League schools playing lacrosse, and your mom and dad bought him a brand-new lacrosse helmet on Amazon, and you stuck it on his head, and he goes out there. He takes a hit, causes permanent brain damage, and he's going to be wheelchair bound for the rest of his life. He's going to be whatever. He's going to be drooling. I mean, it's not going to be a good situation, and he's going to be like that forever. And now you say, okay, well, the only person you get to sue to try to make yourself right is Bob and Susie Smith, whose kid played lacrosse, and they sold his helmet off when he said he didn't want to play anymore. And they rent a house, they have no savings, they got a little bit of money in a 401k, and if you sued them for everything they got, you might walk away with $10,000. The idea is companies like Amazon and entities like Amazon, number one, have insurance. They have insurance to protect them against liability. Number two is they've got the deep pockets to where if Amazon had to cut a check for $1 million to make sure little Tommy is taken care of for the rest of his life, it's not going to kill Amazon. And little Tommy's going to get taken care of. Does it seem nasty and dirty and gross? Absolutely. But you have to accept the reality of it is that the ability to sue where the deep pockets are sometimes is done only for the sake of the victim, because if you didn't let them do it, the victim would never be made whole.
Well, that's all. That's a nice package that you've wrapped up in a bow and wrapping paper.
Oh, yeah.
My problem with it is that person that went out and played lacrosse and ended up in a wheelbarrow. Sometimes
life sucks.
Sometimes life sucks, and I feel like, especially like if it was a solid helmet and did what it was supposed to do, but at the same time, one in a million shot, he gets kicked in the neck and now he's paralyzed. That's not
the same thing.
It's not the same thing. So we'll take that away. But even so you're saying if the helmet fails, but you still have to prove, even if he got kicked in the neck and was paralyzed, that case is still going to court. You know,
absolutely. And you have to prove all the steps. So here's where the multiple layers of a civil lawsuit come into play.
Well, my problem is that even if Amazon has insurance and they end up paying this dude $1 million. That's going to have a trickle-down effect to some degree, especially because they're going to have 10 or 15 or 20. So that ends up coming down to the resellers that are, like you said, mom and pop are reselling stuff for $10, $20. It's going to end up coming out of their fees and more so. So it all trickles down.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, come on.
Because what do you think Amazon's going to do? If the helmet fails, what do you
think?
Their
stock's going to drop.
If the Amazon didn't make it, Amazon
but
just...
But if they're paying it off to get the lawsuit out,
so Amazon,
they're going to pay it off, and then they're going to stop the sellers. You're no longer allowed to sell that item.
No,
this is where we're going to differ on this.
If it fails, Amazon is going to seek indemnity from the manufacturer of the helmet, and they're going to pay it off, and they're going to sue that one in a very quiet lawsuit, and the helmet manufacturer is going to cut a check and say, "Our bad, you're right, that one was a defective. Here's your check. We'll send you $800,000 of the million you paid. The kid's taken care of. We'll cover part of your legal costs. And just don't bring us up in the press because we're still trying to sell helmets here. And that's how it goes away. Because nobody wants to hear the lawsuit between Amazon and Helmet Manufacturer Co. They want to hear the lawsuit between mom and dad of crippled kid and Amazon. And once that one's gone and the press dies down, then they sue the helmet manufacturer. They settle it up.
I'll concede with that. I think that, yeah. It happens all the time. I never thought of that. So, yeah, I don't think most people don't. I mean, you don't see the stuff that goes on behind the scenes as to how it works. You like you said, you see the lawsuits of David and Goliath family versus Amazon family versus Ford or whatever.
But what you always look back to is that at some point in time, the ultimately accountable party is going to be held accountable. It's not flashy, it's not newsworthy, but like I said earlier, it's about the flow of commerce, and it's also about the stream of commerce. So when you look at a product's liability situation, you look at those who received money for it and were involved in the transportation of it and were involved in the actual flowing of it from manufacturer to final consumer. So ultimately, at the end of the day, everybody knows if something was designed, built, and put on somebody's head and it fails, not because of shipping, not because of packaging, not because it was stored in an inclimate condition, it failed because of a design defect. You might have to sue the guy that sold it to you, but at some point in time, we call it the does. So if I file a lawsuit against somebody in civil court, and I don't know everybody that's involved, I just know that this weed whacker blew up and took my client's eye off or out, I'm going to sue him and does 1 through 20. And does 1 through 20 is our way of saying we don't know exactly who's responsible for my client having no eye, but somebody in this stream of commerce is on the hook. And as we do discovery and do evidentiary hearings and do propoundings of evidence, I'm going to eventually get to somebody that is probably more apt to be responsible for it, but I'm starting with the person that sold it to him. So if you – and there's different conditions to that. Like in your situation where you're reselling stuff, you're not held to the same standard as a merchant in that industry. You are a reseller. You have no obligation to inspect it to make sure it's safe. You're basically saying, hey, look, what's in my shop is for sale. I don't know much about some of it, but check it out if you're interested, take it. Somebody buys a receiver that you didn't go through, they take it to the house, it blows up and burns the house down. As a reseller, you're not a merchant who regularly deals in that line of product, then at that point in time, your liability level comes way down. It may end up coming back on Harman Kardon or coming back on Marantz that says, okay, well, you guys designed this improperly to begin with, and that's what caused the fire. You may be a party to the suit, but you seek indemnity based off the fact that you're not a merchant in that industry.
It's not my bag.
It goes back to them. Which is where it should actually eventually fall back to begin with. But you might have to pay a lawyer, unfortunately. You wouldn't, because I owe you so much now that it's not even funny. But
we're getting ridiculously close to even, though. I feel like we are getting ridiculously close to even.
No, because I have a barbecue competition in 2 weeks. You'll get some credit. You'll get some credit.
I'll need credit, I'm sure. But that's a lot of stupid things, so.
But that's how it kind of plays. Ultimately, the right person usually pays the price. It's just a matter of how long it takes to get to the right person.
And I really thought that this would kind of be a boring legal interview, but you have put a lot of things into perspective. As, like you said, it's not glamorous, so we don't see it because you only get to see what the news or the media tells you, and so you don't see the lawsuits between the big companies because it's irrelevant.
It's not even. It might be a filed lawsuit. Two lawyers go have lunch at the country club, and the thing is settled in 20 minutes, and the lawyers make their – I wish I had that kind of gig. That'd be awesome.
I wish you had that kind of gig.
Right? We live in large, kid.
We would have a lot of great lunches.
But that's kind of how it plays out. It's all for the stream of commerce. It's as long as there's not a deceptive withholding of a serious defect that's causing – multiple little Tommies running around in wheelchairs or wheelbarrows or whatever the case may be. If it's a one-off, let's deal with the one-off. Let's make the party whole. We'll figure out who owes the money between the big pockets where the money really sits. And you leave the little guy out of it so that they're not the one because, again, the mom and pop don't want to have to pay the price. They can't pay the price. You make Amazon and the helmet manufacturer figure it out. and everybody else is fine, and they don't really care.
Interesting. Oops. Sorry, kicking stuff underneath the desk. You probably didn't even hear that anyway, so. Well, that, is there anything, you said that you just recently went through the laws that were for the, for but, auctions. Is there anything new and exciting that came around?
Nothing as much has changed, other than I think a lot of people need to understand that if you go to an auction and that they don't tell you that this has got a this is a non-reserve auction, then you always have to realize that it is a reserved auction, which means the auctioneer can kill the auction at any time.
He can do what he wants. He has carte blanche. He can do anything he wants.
The big challenge, I think, going forward with the online auctions is the missed bid. The missed bid concept is that if I'm an auctioneer at a live auction and I don't see the guy that's off to my right because I got a bad eye or whatever the case may be, and I drop the gavel, if my spotter in the crowd says, no, you have a bid over here, the auctioneer can reopen the bid as long as it's a reasonable duration of time from when the bid was placed or when the auction was closed.
How do you define what a reasonable...
That's the problem. Reasonable is subjective, and the courts are eventually going to be faced with having to figure out how to define a reasonable time.
It's such a small market, though. I mean, again,
it is now.
You have to go... It's
going to be an eBay case or a Poshmark case, or you're going to have a pair of like Air Jordans pop up on Poshmark that are a one of a kind. These are the
Poshmark isn't an auction site. They are
is it straight bid?
It's a straight sale. Like I have this up for $500.
So it's going to come down to an eBay thing, kind of like your sterling silver plate.
The Bulls. Yeah.
It's going to be somebody who says, "No, I submitted a bid. Here's my proof."
Yeah.
And they're going to say, well, we didn't get it in time. And they're going to say, well, I submitted it 10 seconds before the auction closed. You need to reopen that auction and give me an opportunity to bid. And if you reopen it for that person, you need to reopen it for everybody.
Well, I think the online storage auctions have done a very good job of that. eBay, I have never, in 20 years of being on eBay, I've never understood why eBay has not done this. But all the auction sites... for storage units, if you bid within the last 3 minutes or 4 minutes or 2 minutes, it opens the auction back up for another 2 minutes. If it's down, if it goes down to the last 4 seconds and you throw in a bid, now all of a sudden it's back up to 2 minutes and 4 seconds because it gives that person a chance. Because that's realistically what an auction should be and what it is. Whereas eBay is all sniping. Everybody, like, that's why auctions, mm-hmm. eBay's auctions have died. It's now, buy it now is what eBay is.
But here's going to be the case. It's not going to be the buyer suing eBay. It's going to be the internet provider who had a lag situation.
Yeah, of course.
That's going to get sued and is going to seek indemnity from eBay, saying you didn't keep it open long enough to make sure there was no outstanding bids. That's going to be your lawsuit that forces somebody to step in and say, okay, it's now time to set a time limit, or what is the reasonable definition for keeping an online auction open to make sure there was no other bids prior to closing the auction.
Doesn't eBay already have a precedence as being eBay for 22 years to know that when an auction ends? I mean, that's what it is. If you didn't get your bid, it's sorry. I mean...
So I'll give you one of the biggest civil lawsuits that ever got settled back in the 90s. The Ford Explorers.
Right.
How long had Ford been in business as a predominant automobile manufacturer? Going back into the early 1900s, 90 years later, they get sued. This benchmark of American industry, and lost miserably and lost a ton of money. Never, ever, ever think that because somebody's been doing it for so long that they're above reproach. Because the minute they feel they're above reproach and everybody views them above reproach is when they do things that are below reproach and are going to get them in trouble.
I agree with that. Above and below reproach is there's a difference between like what you're saying is Ford Explorer or Exploder. They had a failed product. eBay has... not changed in 25 years. This is what they do. This is how they run their company. They have to have a precedence of this is how it works.
But the problem is that because they're a unique entity that's been around for that long, laws have not been put into place to protect consumers, to protect resellers, and to protect eBay. And because that hasn't been put into place, there's gray areas. The idea of the law is to pull the gray out of the equation to set forth solid rules of operation that are legally founded in order to ensure that both consumer, seller, and third party have protection and have rights. And the current situation, what if the person who bought that silver bowl, what if the other bidder whose bid didn't go through because Verizon screwed up and their system was all jacked up for that 45 seconds was denied being able to complete a full set of those bowls. And now all of a sudden the one bowl that's come up in the last 20-something years on eBay got sold to somebody else and this person needed it. And now they're going, my collection now is only worth $20,000, but if I had all three, it's worth $80,000. I'm going to sue Verizon. And if I sue Verizon Internet and Wireless, Verizon Internet and Wireless is going to say, whoa, it's not our fault. It should be known that Internet sometime doesn't work, and eBay should have taken that into consideration.
Doesn't that boil back to where this entire conversation started, is what's the point? If there's going to be one case where it's a $5 million car where all of a sudden it matters, but majority of the time it's $1,000 or 50 cent or whatever transaction it is where they're like, whatever, you're not going to take this to court.
Exactly.
So you're waiting for that one, the legal system basically is what you're saying, is waiting for that one case where it's like all of a sudden it's precedent. You have a $5 million car that sold for $1 million because my internet died, and even though I'm stupid and waited until the last second, I can take this to court.
Well, you even look at, one of the most substantial changes and shifts in watching a group of people go from impoverished to extremely wealthy. Look at the Indian tribes that have been able to bring in Indian gambling. You had a little tiny card shop here in the Coachella Valley, little tiny poker room back in the 60s and early 70s that sparked this entire movement of Indians saying, well, if I can't do it, why are you letting the rest of the state of California do it? And why are you letting them have lotteries, but I can't do games of chance as well? And it took years to work its way through the Supreme Court. But this one little tiny poker house here in Indio, Old Town Indio, set a precedent that went all the way to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court said, no, if the state allows it, then the Indians get to do it, even though they're on tribal federal land, we're going to allow it. It wasn't about the amount of money that was involved in it, was about the principle. And the Indians had just enough money to fight that fight. And you had attorneys who saw that, okay, if we win this fight, whoo, we're going to be rich. So they took it all the way to the max. And once it went to the max, they could do the fight. But it still took 15 years.
Yeah.
So you have to look at the fact that it's going to take one person at some point in time to say, no, I'm putting my foot down. I really needed that bowl to complete my collection. I'm a billionaire. Yeah. I'll pay attorneys for the next 15 years if I have to, and I'm going to sue you on the backside for attorney's fees to go along with it, and then I'm going to bankrupt and I'll end up owning eBay. Maybe.
So for all of those people that are wondering what the hell we're talking about with this bowl, so the story, this has never been talked about on the podcast. I had a couple of husband and wife come in, and they vetted me realistically. And I'm totally fine with that. And I tell everybody that comes into my shop, I was like, look, do not sell to me because I am a reseller. You cannot trust me even though I'm a trustworthy guy. You should not trust me. If you don't know what you're selling, don't sell it. If you know what you're selling, then know what you want for it. Don't ask me what I'm willing to pay for it because I'm going to go low because that's my job.
As your attorney, I really wish you would quit saying that.
I don't care.
I know you
because,
don't.
Because realistically, to me, anybody that comes in my shop that is selling me something is gravy in my boat.
Yes.
It's not what I do. So if you're going to come in here and sell me a stack of records, I'm going to tell you what they're worth, and I will absolutely tell you 100% this record is worth $25 in the condition it's in. I'm going to give you $12.54 because I think I can double. I at least want to double my money on it. If it's a $3 record, I'm probably not going to pay you much of anything for it because right now I'm running a sale in the shop. All my $3 records are 50 cents. And that happens every once in a while, so they're not really worth anything to me. But anyway, so this bowl that he's talking about, this couple came in, and they had gone to a couple other places, and they were not happy with a bunch of sellers that came or that had come to their house, and I'm not going to get into that because of the people involved in it. I know them, and they're shady. And again, the point of it is be very, very careful who you invite into your house and who you think is going to be good to you and who is not. So they came into the shop and they said, I have a bunch of sterling silver that was left to me and I'd like to sell it off for scrap. And I said, okay, I do buy scrap silver. I will occasionally. I'll pay you spot prices on it because it's not something I sell. I just hold on to it. I have like this room in my house that's my dragon's lair of gold and silver. I've never sold any gold or any silver that I've ever found. I do sell silver jewelry. I started to because it's worth more than scrap value.
It's part of his zombie apocalypse vampire werewolf attack program.
That is true. Yes. If anything hits the fan, then I know that we're good. I've got tradability and I have ammunition and all that stuff and I have knowledge and stuff. So I was like, yeah, you can bring it in, no problem. So they brought in a bunch of sterling silver. It ended up scrapping out at somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,000, $2,500, maybe $3,000. And I said, okay, look, at this point I was still pretty new in the shop and I was sliding by monthly. And I said, guy, I really appreciate you bringing this into me. And I said, if I could, I would absolutely buy this from you. I said, but I cannot invest $2,000 in silver into my armoire or my armory for zombie apocalypse time. I said, but I know a guy that will give you scrap for it. I think he'll pay, like I said, I think it was $2,500. He will pay spot, and there's very, very few people that will pay spot, and that's the value of the silver. And you can take it up to him. I said, but you have these three bowls in this lot that I said, I don't think you should scrap these out. I said, I did some research. I cannot find the maker. I have no idea what it is. They are very, very well done. I don't know anything about them. I said, but I would be more than happy to put these online for you to see what happens. I said, worst case scenario, I'm going to start them at scrap value, so you're going to get the scrap minus eBay fees. But let's just see what happens. I said, it's probably worth it. I said, I think they're worth more than scrap. I don't know who they are. Let's try it. I'm like, okay, fine. So I polished them up. I did my best job. I didn't take the tarnish. I took the tarnish off, but I knew at this point it wasn't something that if you clean the patina off, it was going to be bad. I listed them at scrap, the scrap value on them. These bowls weighed out at like 800 grams or 600 grams, so I think they were probably $500 or $600 in scrap. I listed them at $600. Immediately, within 30 seconds, I was at scrap value. And then it just kind of stopped for 7 days. And I was like, well, all right, no big deal. I mean, they're at least going to get their scrap. And they were at the beach, and they were actually watching it on their phone, but their phone didn't refresh when the auction ended. I remember this, and I'll never forget this day for the rest of my life.
Well, you called me right when it happened. So I was like, what?
I was walking out into my garage. I was doing laundry, so I put my phone on the washer, and I was pulling stuff out of the dryer, and I refreshed, and again, it was still at like $600 or whatever, blah, blah, blah. It hadn't gone anywhere. And I refreshed it, and all of a sudden, it's at $2,000. I refreshed it again, and again, there's only 15 seconds left in this auction. I refreshed it again, now it's at $10,000. I refreshed it again, auction has ended, and it ended at $21,000.
And I get a phone call about 10 minutes after, because I think I was coming over for Friday drinks after work.
Happy hour at the shop.
Yeah, happy hour, but it wasn't going to be at the shop, it was going to be at your house. So I get this phone call, he's like, you are not going to believe what just happened. And I was like, what did Chelsea do? What happened? I have no idea.
Well, so I called them immediately. I was like, did you see what happened? Did you see what happened? And they're like, well, we saw that it didn't end for anything. I was like, no, you need to refresh your phone. They're like, why? I was like, it just sold for $21,000. And they're like, what? So the guy that bought them immediately called me. And I said, I don't know how. His first thing, when I answered the phone, I was like, hello. He's like, so I guess you're probably pretty shocked. And I said, a little bit. He's like, I see you've been on eBay for a long time. He's like, but you've found yourself a honey hole here. And he had been selling silver his entire life, 50 plus years. He's like, those are Saarinen bowls. Saarinen is the designer. He also was an architect and did houses and stuff. Like, very, very extremely rare. He's like, I've been buying and selling and collecting silver my entire life. He's like, you sold that set of three. You had two of one bowl and one of the other. He's like, the two that you have are the smaller bowls. I see those very, very, very infrequently. The larger bowl, that's probably more like a salad bowl kind of thing, he's like, I've never seen that in my entire life. He's like, that's why you got... He's like, the other guy that was bidding against me, we are the two biggest silver guys, and he was out of Georgia. I said, okay, well, that's all fine and dandy. I said, how do I ship this? He's like, very, very carefully.
I think you called me and was like, so what should I do? I was like, insure it?
I told him, I was like, do you want me to fly out there? I was like, I will buy a $500 plane ticket and fly out there and handle them. He's like, no, no. He's like, you just need to overnight them FedEx, insure them. Insurance on that was like $285 or $400, and he paid it. He's like, that's fine, just pay the insurance. And he got him. He was funny. When he got him, he's like, they arrived damaged. And then he's like, just kidding. He's like, oh, that's not cool at all. So that was the thing. And they ended up, I gave them every cent of that. I said, I didn't do this because I was trying to make a profit. I said, I just felt like there was probably something more to it. They ended up kicking me a couple, I think they kicked me like $1,500 for the sale, and they covered the eBay fees and all that stuff. They were totally cool, and I was very happy to do it for them because he needed back surgery. He was a landscaper, and it helped him out quite a bit. So, again, I tend to, through this podcast, come across as a great person. I'm really not.
No, he's not. He's horrible.
I have a couple of good stories where I've actually helped some people out, but for the most part, I'm an ass.
For every one time he helps somebody, there's like 35 where you're like, wow, dude, how could you do that to people?
I don't like
people. Actually, that's not true.
I don't like people a lot.
That's not true. You're a good guy.
No, don't do that.
He's a good guy.
So anyway, this podcast has run a little long. I'm actually really, really happy with this. I've always loved hanging out with Mike, and we always have a good time together, but I wasn't sure how the legalese of this would go. I hope everybody enjoyed it. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you have questions for Mike or if you need a lawyer, you can contact me through finderslq@gmail.com. You can contact Mike.
You can contact me at mgaylorlaw.com. There's a message site linked to it, so it'll send me an email if you have any questions or anything I can help you out with. Please let me know. My first hour is always a free consult. I'll help you out if I can. This has been more of a opportunity to sit down and have a cocktail and have a conversation with my good friend about something he's passionate about, and I think it came out pretty good.
I agree. And again, if you find us on findersthrift.com or finders_thrift on Instagram, or if you're a record collector, finders_vinyl, if you have any questions for Mike or if you need any legal issues, again, contact him where he just said. As always, thank you so much for listening. Good luck out there and happy hunting.
Good luck, guys. If you need anything, let us know. Peace.